This is Thursday Night Talk. Tonight, Sharon Fennell will be our host, along with our guest by phone, Mary Buser. We welcome your contributions. Give us a call at 826-4805, or if you're out of the area, toll-free at 800-640-5911, and to our text line at 492-KHSU.
You song for the guys over here in the front yelling, on the hole, and the guys way in the back yelling, on the hole, on the hole.
Good evening and welcome to On the Line on Thursday Night Talk. I'm your host, Sharon Fennell. Did you know that on any given day in the United States of America, there are between 80 and 100,000 human beings held in some form of solitary confinement? This includes teenagers and those who suffer from mental illness. I recently became aware of one of the many groups and organizations that seek to educate us about the futility and harm meted out to those held in solitary. One such organization is Social Workers Against Solitary Confinement. Social workers and other health professionals in the jail and prison setting are addressing the very real ethical conflicts that arise within their hearts and minds as they try to help some of the most vulnerable among us in the most punitive and draconian places. The former UN Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, and Degrading Treatment, Juan Mendez, declared in 2016 that even 15 days in solitary confinement is torture. Local listeners should be well aware of the prison in our backyard that earned a name for itself when it opened in 1989, that being Pelican Bay State Prison in Crescent City, California. As a result of a series of hunger strikes in 2013, the prisoners held in solitary at Pelican Bay filed and won a class action lawsuit that changed the terms of who, how, and why men would be placed in solitary moving forward. My guest for the hour is Mary E. Buser. Mary is part of Social Workers Against Solitary and the author of the book published in 2015 titled Lockdown on Rikers. It is the story of Mary's journey as a newly minted social worker who lands an internship at Rikers, and that is where we begin. Mary, thank you, and welcome to On the Line at this late hour of the evening for you on the East Coast.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Very nice to be here with you, Sharon.
Right on. And those of you who would like to speak with Mary, just hold your thoughts and questions for a little bit as we proceed and get this conversation going. All right, so Mary, an amazing book, but first let's talk about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were educated, what made you decide to become a social worker?
Well, I'm from, as you mentioned, New York, Long Island, grew up in a large middle-class family. And I always, for some reason, as a kid, had an interest in civil rights, had an interest in the struggle in this country with racism. Although I was not exposed to very much, I kind of grew up in a fairly white community, as I said, middle class. But as I got older, I was more drawn to wanting to be more involved in these issues. And when I went to get my master's degree at Columbia, my first year of field work was at Rikers Island, and I was assigned to work with incarcerated women to provide them with emotional and psychiatric support. And while everybody else thought this was a horrible assignment, my fellow students, I was very intrigued about what this was about and just how I might connect with these women.
Mm.
And it actually, that first year, turned out very well. What I discovered was that we are all human. I was trying to work with these women one-on-one to help them to find a better path for themselves. I never felt in any type of danger. I connected very easily and just saw the promise in everyone, really. Mm-hmm. And when I left after that first year, I just felt that this was kind of my calling. That after I got my master's degree, I wanted to return to Rikers as a therapist. And, you know, as you learned in the book, that's really when the wheels started coming off, when I was assigned, you know, Rikers is a complex of 10 jails. And I was assigned to one of the men's jails at that point, and things started to change very much for me.
All right. Tell us a little bit about, I just want to take a couple of steps back, because before you got into all of this, you had an affiliation with something called Lifeline and the Samaritans.
Yes.
So what were those organizations about?
All righty. When I got out of college, like a lot of kids coming out of college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was living in Boston, and I thought I would try some volunteer work. And I started volunteering on this hotline called the Samaritans, which it is a non-religious organization 24 hours a day staffed by volunteers. And we learned very simple techniques for listening to callers, talking to people very openly about feeling suicidal.
Mm.
And I was very impressed with just the power of the human connection in bringing relief to people in some of their most desperate moments. And I was so taken with it that I started getting involved with other aspects of it, one of which was called Lifeline. And Lifeline was an extension of the Samaritans that was started when the Charles Street Jail was just kind of overwhelmed with suicides in the jail in Boston. And they came to the Samaritans and said, "Can you help us?" And the Samaritans went in, and they trained some of the inmates as Samaritans. And the same type of training that I received as a volunteer, they received 6 weeks of training, and then they became Samaritans within the jail.
Mm.
And yes, which was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Lifeline volunteers, I joined them. We would go in every Wednesday night and sit around a table with the Samaritans behind bars to talk about how the week went inside the jail. And, you know, in the beginning, everyone thought this is ridiculous in a place where, you know, people will yell, "Jump, jump," you know, and so callous the expectation. And the reality was, after the Samaritans intervened, through that effort, the suicide, the numbers, it dropped to zero.
Wow.
Nothing. Just nothing. So it was so powerful, so powerful. Mm-hmm. Regardless of where you go in this world, we're all people. And those Samaritan you know, inmates did an amazing job talking to especially the newly arrested and applying the same techniques of caring, listening, etc. And it had an immediate and profound impact. And so what happened was, after a couple of years working there, I just said to myself, this is it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do this. So I'm from the New York area. I came back down here, banded together with some former Boston Samaritans to start the Samaritans of New York City.
Wow.
So that was about a 6-year undertaking of fundraising, of, getting volunteers. And at that time, no one spoke about suicide, so I was learning how difficult it was to raise money. It was not, as they call it, a sexy cause.
Exactly. Yeah.
Come a long way since then, but then I became the first executive director, and it was pretty amazing. And then we worked with the police department and the speakers bureau, and so that was a big part of the way I spent my 20s working with the Samaritans.
Yeah, that's beautiful. What part of Long Island are you from?
The South Shore, Suffolk County, Babylon.
Babylon, okay. You know, I'm from the South Bronx, and so I have relatives that used to live on Long Island, and so I was just curious about that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so
neighbors.
Yeah, practically. Oh, you know, and this is just a little funny sidebar. You know, I was looking for a little cloth bag to carry my stuff up here to the studio, and one of my friends had given me a gift some time ago. I forgot about it, and it's a little handbag, and it says The Bronx on it, and it's got a map, sort of not a real map in the sense, but it lays out the Bronx with pictures and such. And so I'm looking at my neighborhood, and right below the Hunts Point section of the Bronx is Rikers Island, and there's a little insignia of a person in stripes, you know, a prisoner with a ball and chain attached to their legs on this very little bag that I brought here to carry my stuff. And when I saw that today, I said, this is like, you know, like, ha, we're talking about Rikers tonight, and there it is on my little bag. All righty, enough of that. So, you know, When I was a kid growing up in the South Bronx, the mere mention of Rikers Island was the place you never wanted to end up, and there were always threats. If you don't watch what you're doing, you're going to end up at Rikers, Rikers. It was a mantra on my street. So, what is Rikers? Where is Rikers?
Okay, great.
Island.
Such important questions, because even though everyone, you know, as you just said, you know, Rikers was this big threat, and yet if you ask people just where Rikers is, people scratch their heads. And I'll tell you the reason right now. Mm-hmm. It is approximately 400-acre island in New York City's East River, but you cannot see it from parkways. You can't see it from sidewalks, so no one knows where it is. The best way to see it is if you fly in or out of LaGuardia Airport. At the end of the runways, if you see what looks like an industrial complex in barbed wire, that's Rikers Island. So, again, very difficult to glimpse it unless you are, you know, from the air. You can, and most people don't even realize what it is. People are not allowed out on the grounds. You know, recreation areas are with inside the jails. So it looks like a very kind of empty place. And yet it is a complex of 10 jails, 9 for men, 1 for women. And it's jail versus prison, which is a very important distinction.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, very important, especially when we get into the question of bail. Mm-hmm. Jails are for people who have been charged with a crime but not convicted. So what this means is, you know, why would they be behind bars? Typically it's because they can't afford bail. And bail is kind of the insurance that people pay to kind of ensure that they will show up for their hearings while the case is being resolved. Now, if you don't have the money, then the system is not going to take a chance that you're going to show up. They're going to say, we're going to put you on behind bars while we wait for your case to resolve, which is just so grossly unfair. For reasons I'm sure that we're going to get into, but I was pretty stunned to discover that the big reason that people were on Rikers was not necessarily a question of guilt or innocence, because that had yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. It was a function of money. So, you know, what we see is that Rikers Island is very much for the poor. If you've been arrested in one of New York City's 5 boroughs, and bail has been set, which in most cases it is, and you can't afford it, you're likely going to go to Rikers Island while you await the outcome of the case. And contrary to what we're told about speedy trial, you can sit on Rikers for years waiting for your, quote, day in court.
Mm-hmm. So a series of 10 jails on 400 acres that are holding people who are still deemed innocent until proven guilty. And the breadth of these people, besides being indigent, are there for very serious crimes or what?
Everything. Mm. Everything in the world, from loitering and trespassing to rape, arson, murder. It's a potpourri of everything. If you cannot make bail, it's Rikers Island.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of, once you get there, they will take people who have more serious charges. They might be placed in cell blocks versus dorms. But that's about the only difference.
Mm-hmm.
People
mm-hmm.
with low-level charges are typically in dorms. And I would just qualify one thing. The 10 buildings, one of them is technically a prison. It's for people who have been sentenced, but the sentence is 1 year or less. And sometimes they will permit people to serve that year or less on Rikers where they can be closer to family. So technically speaking, one of those buildings is a prison, and the people inside of them, prisoners. Everyone else is what's known as a detainee. So all the 9 other jails are for detainees, and that's the mainstay of the Rikers population.
No. All right, now, if you're just tuning in, I'm Sharon Fennell, and I'm speaking with Mary Booser, and she's written the book Lockdown on Rikers, Shocking Stories of Abuse and Injustice at New York's Notorious Jail. How did you get the internship at Rikers? Was working in a jail setting, you know, something you had thought about? I know you went into that in the beginning, but just, you know, rehash that a little bit.
Sure, sure. Well, it's kind of funny because they gave us a list, kind of, you know, put a number next to, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever, in terms of your, you know, what you would like the most. And
are you talking at Columbia when you
yes.
were, at school, all right.
Mm-hmm. And I saw correctional facility, and I paused, and I remembered that Lifeline experience with the Samaritans, having worked in that jail,
mm-hmm.
and how satisfying, how fulfilling that was, and how
mm-hmm.
meaningful it was,
yeah.
and I thought, what the heck? And I put number one next to correctional facility. I wasn't really familiar with Rikers. I didn't know what this would mean, and afterwards, I learned I was probably the first person in the history of Columbia to put jail
as your
their
first choice.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But I did, and they absolutely then assigned me. Yes.
And what did your friends and family think about your work in, you know, that you were going to go work in the nastiest jail among the many vile jails in our country?
I would say they pretty much freaked out. It was people were astonished, you know, you're going to get killed, you're going to get raped, you're going to get a disease, you're going to get AIDS, you're going to die, are you crazy, can you get out of it? Mm. And then when they accepted that, you know, I was going to be there for the year, I think they settled down with the idea that, all right, you're a student, you'll just be there for a year, it's a women's jail, it's kind of tame. But then the real horror came when I announced that I was going back. It is not for everyone, but I knew it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an uphill battle in terms of people's reactions, which is very telling. And part of the reason I wanted to write the book was to bridge the gap between all these things people think and the
yes.
reality of who is behind bars. There are brothers, sisters, cousins, neighbors, you know, they're not people from another planet. They're human beings.
Yep. Amen.
So, yeah.
So your first stop was in the women's jail. So let's talk about that. You were in the Rose Singer building. Tell us about Rose Singer and just expound on who were the women so situated and why were they there for the most part. Tell us if these women had contact visits with their loved ones, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, at that time, yes, they allowed contact visits. I think they've been trying to eliminate that more recently. So that was a little bit of a blessing. But in terms of who these women were, I would sum it all, or why they were there, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I would sum it up all in one word, which is drugs.
Mm-hmm.
All roads led to drugs on Rikers Island, whether people were selling, buying, working as lookouts, committing some crime while under the influence, or, in a desperate attempt to get more drugs. That was the theme that ran mm-hmm. through everyone virtually that I sat down and spoke with. And I really saw this as a timeout in their lives, their incarceration. You know, some of those women said to me, if I hadn't have gotten locked up, I don't know what would have happened to me. I would have been dead. A lot of prostitution as a means of getting drugs. So when you sit with someone one-on-one, kind of in the sanctity of a therapeutic relationship, and they pour out their heart to you, it was a privilege for me to listen to what someone struggled with, what they grew up with, perhaps an addicted parent or no parents, just trying to make their way in the world and having a very difficult time of it. And I kind of saw this as trying to give a little lifeline of listening and guidance and helping these women to grow. Most of them, just about all of them, would be returning, and trying to help them to find a better way for themselves. And I really, as I said, connected with everyone. I never felt in danger. I remember my supervisor at one point saying, I'm going to give you more of a challenge. I'm assigning a woman here for murder. And up to then, I had basically worked with, women for shoplifting and low-level mm-hmm. crimes. And her story was so, in the beginning I was nervous, a murderer. But again, a human being who, drugs, and someone, she had been herself brutally raped and made a decision that no one would ever jump on her back again or hurt her again. And she was treated so cruelly in the hospital after she was raped by the police and by hospital staff. She was beaten so badly, it took months for her to be able to walk again. And she received no counseling. That was it. Her body was mended, but her spirit was so damaged that she carried a little pocket knife and vowed no one would ever hurt her again.
Wow.
And in the course of some type of horseplay with some other friends, someone did not get off her back, and as a warning, she jabbed, not meaning to really hurt the person, but you never know.
That was her trigger.
Yeah. And the person died. And she was now in for murder. And, part of our work was just for her to reveal the whole story of the rape and everything that happened. You couldn't help but, it was such a human situation, and wonder how I or anybody else mm-hmm. would have handled something as traumatic as what she'd been through. So again, murderer, human being.
Yeah.
And that was I wrote about her in the book,
yes.
our work together, and that was a very important relationship for both of us. And that's what that year was about, relationships with these women. And they had a nursery there. I worked with the mothers in the nursery. And if you gave birth on Rikers, you could keep the baby for up to 1 year of your incarceration.
Mm. Yeah. And then what?
The baby would have to go out because they did not want the baby to start to become aware of its surroundings. So the baby would have to go out to the woman's family or to foster care. That's assuming that her case had not yet resolved. And that was the nursery was a part of my life there, and the babies and the group. Mm. And there was an adolescent group as well. And I was told in the beginning that, these girls are basically animals and you're wasting your time. And, again, sat working. I mean, these girls just group homes and just the worst upbringings we can imagine. And
right.
And even they would come around. No one really wants to fight or be violent. People want to be heard, and that group developed. So it was all, for me, that first year, very wonderful and very promising.
Yeah, I feel you, you know. I really do. It just strikes me, though, too, you know, so many of the people that end up incarcerated in our country are those without means and people of color. Mm-hmm. And these women that you describe, especially the ones that are there for drugs, for some it's a crime of economy. You know, you sell drugs to make a little money.
Yes.
No judgment, but that's what people do. And the other side of that is you self-medicate. And this is what we see in our society today, all over the place. And we haven't figured out what's what are we going to do? All right.
But one thing I want to comment on that, and this is something that really bothers me, is that we're seeing now, since this opioid epidemic has hit all levels of society, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, a dear friend of his died of an overdose. So he's come out saying, you know, addiction is a brain disease, and we have to do something. And we have this kind of mainstream reaction now to it. But my heart kind of breaks for, you know, the decades of people who were just kind of spat upon, you know, and it would have been, you know, people of color and referred to as, you know, junkies and, you know, low lives and scales. And I'm glad that we're starting to see a change in our attitude about drug addiction.
Right.
But, people have been very mistreated over this.
You betcha. Yeah. Now, so you moved around Rikers in various jobs, and you finally land a job in what we in California call the SHU, the security housing units. How did this all happen?
Well, when I came back to Rikers Island after I got my master's degree, I was sent to a men's jail, and I worked there for several years. It was a maximum security jail as a therapist. And it was a lot different than my experience with the women, but nonetheless, it was gratifying. But then I was promoted to an assistant chief of mental health, and which kind of took me off the front lines. But I saw it as an opportunity for good management of mental health services, and I was assigned to different posts. And my final post on Rikers Island was to what you call the SHU. At Rikers, they called it the Bing. And it was the 500-cell solitary confinement unit, which was the island's jail within jail. So for any infractions on the island, except for women, did not get sent there. They had a housing unit in the jail. But all men in those nine jails would be bused to the Bing to serve a sentence for a ticket, meaning if they incurred some type of an infraction. Mm. Yeah.
And that could be anything from disrespecting an officer to, you know,
assault on staff.
Okay.
Yeah.
So something a bit on the serious side, would you say?
Well, it ranged. Ah. You could be sent there for, you know, walking out of a housing unit wearing a hat, because that's breaking a rule.
Oh.
You would probably then get, I don't know, 10 days. Assault on staff, you would get 3 months.
Wow.
That was considered the most serious.
Wow.
But what I discovered is that I thought 3 months was pretty awful, and now since with the UN saying 15 days is torture, which does not surprise me at all.
Yeah.
But at Rikers, the tickets could also pile up. You know, you could, if they say you attack two officers, now it's 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, you attack three, it just multiplied. They would just stack them up.
Yeah. Were there mentally ill men placed in solitary?
Well, we had a saying, if you had no mental health issues before you entered solitary, you do now.
Yes.
But we, at that time, would try to screen out if someone each jail had a clinic and a mental observation unit. So anyone on a mental observation unit could not be placed in solitary until they were released from that unit. So presumably, no, you could not go to solitary. However, they did, while I was there, create a unit just for the mentally ill, which was supposedly a little more humane, but just turned into much of the same.
And some of these people that were placed in this alternative Bing, I be getting that right, suffered from impulse disorders, and they were nonviolent, more or less?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd say the impulse control disorders, they were not in the alternative unit. They were in the Bing.
Oh, wow.
That's one of the things that I discovered. First of all, before I arrived, I was told that anyone in solitary, these people were the worst of the worst, mm-hmm. the baddest of the bad. You know, the whole island was safer because these people were housed, all 500 of them, which was a staggering number. And then when I got up close and I would go into these cells on a daily basis and see what their charges were, I had their charts, discovered that 75% of them were there for a nonviolent infraction.
Mm-hmm.
Only
mm-hmm.
a quarter of the people in there were there for some type of fighting, assault, whatever. The other three quarters were there for disobeying orders and that type of thing, or possession of contraband. And I just started noticing, too, that a lot of the people in there were there for impulse control disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that they, you know, refused to obey, more that they can't, kind of like those little boys acting out, but now, you know, in their early 20s, kind of incorrigible, who need treatment and instead thrown into isolation.
Yeah.
A lot of impulse control disorder inside those.
Once again, my guest is Mary Buser, and she's the author of a book called Lockdown on Rikers. I'll open up the phone lines now before we get into my next line of questioning here. So the number here is 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. I wanted to talk. The time is going so fast.
I know.
Oh, my goodness. And is everything all right in your neighborhood? Because I heard sirens twice.
I know. I tried to move away from the window.
I'm back in New York.
It feels like
practically,
that, doesn't
it? Yeah.
It just goes with the territory in New York.
Yeah, indeed. On a more serious note, suicide and solitary, and you speak about malingering or dying. Explain this criteria for someone who's wanting to get out of solitary or not wanting to get in the first place.
Yeah, it's a very grueling punishment, and people were terrified of it. On Rikers, it just hung like a black cloud over the whole island. And before I worked in that unit, I was in a totally different building. We would often get people who would come to the clinic. They'd have on a referral that they're going to kill themselves or that they hear voices. And you would probe, you would do your evaluation, and you would discover that that really was not the case. It didn't match up, the things that they were claiming, with your observation of the person. And then as I got more seasoned, I learned that a lot of times these people who kind of feigned mental illness or pretended they wanted to kill themselves was because they'd been issued a ticket. And it took a couple of days between the time that you got the ticket till the time that you were bussed over to the Bing. And in this window, people would run to mental health as a way to try to forestall or, you know, stall it, get placed on a mental observation unit where they couldn't be touched at that time. And, you know, it was kind of, you had mixed feelings because you didn't like being lied to. The diagnosis here would be malingering, which is a psychiatric word for a faker. But it also impacted me deeply just how desperate people were to not be sent there. and the lengths that they would go to. They would often cut themselves. They would, you know, feign hangings, and their timing could be off on this stuff. So the levels of desperation to not be sent there were huge, and it was very heartbreaking to see this on a daily basis.
Well, 826-480-5, 1-800-640-5911. We invite your phone calls if you have any questions for Mary about her time on Rikers Island. I want to talk about jail prison culture among guards, otherwise called COs, correction officers. Abusive guards, beating of inmates, the way the guards would yell at them, debase them, and dare I say, tell lies after the fact about what happened. I just want to say I praise you for writing and putting this in your book, because I myself, some people know that, you know, I held court with a Sunday afternoon radio show here at KHSU, and I focused a lot of the program on Pelican Bay State Prison and the men situated there and what I was learning about solitary confinement and all of this. And that became my passion, because when, you know, it was like incredulous to me. What? Yeah. We do this to to folks in our country? I just, like, no. So I had just had to tell everybody about it and get us educated. But the one thing that I feel has never been told, and I only know what I know because I know many inmates, current and now men that are free, that have told me many stories about abusive guards. Can you talk about what you saw on Rikers?
Yes, I can. It was shocking and very disturbing. When I first got there, I wasn't that naive. I assumed that here and there would be some abuses, but that by and large, those would be, you know, very isolated types of things. And what happened was that through my sessions with the inmates, I would meet with people every day. Within the sanctity and confidentiality of the sessions, they started telling me one story after the next of things that were happening. There were these search teams that would come in looking for weapons, and the inmates were terrified of these search teams, who would bang the bars at any hour of the day or night to come in, order everybody against a wall to strip, told not to move a muscle, and then they would just take their sweet old time just trashing everything, family pictures, upending beds, mattresses, and they were always looking for someone to flinch, to turn around. This is what I was told. And then when they did, they would issue a beat down. They would beat the person. And these guys were traumatized, telling me about it, you know, whispering in fear, looking out at an officer out at the desk saying, "My God, it was so bad. He didn't do anything." You know, it was just so, it was traumatizing to be a witness to it. And in the beginning, I thought, well, this is terrible. But then when everyone who you know, there are hundreds of people in this jail. There were about 2,000 people in this one jail. And when you're hearing the same story again and again from people who don't know each other, you know you're hearing the truth.
Yeah.
But then, you know, what would happen is people were showing up with black eyes. You know, in one case I wrote about this poor guy who was in the throes of bipolar disorder in the manic phase, which I discovered people in that phase are particularly vulnerable. They're just not responsive in the way that is expected because their brain chemistry is off, and but it's not interpreted that way, and there's nothing you could tell the COs. They'll tell you, we'll fix it, and that means violence. So this poor guy, you know, I knew he was in danger, and I transferred him to another jail to get him a higher level of care, to get him medicated. But even at this other jail, he returned few weeks later, and I went to see him to see how he was doing. I didn't know what had happened. He turned around, and his front teeth were gone.
Oh.
His nose was broken. His eyes were like the color of coal. And he just whispered, "They did this to me. They did this to me."
Yeah.
I was horrified. And, you know, he said they just took me out in a hall, and a captain walked by. He said, no one heard me. No one cared. And why did they do it? And, you know, another fellow just told me, coming from the law library one day, he was just attacked. Apparently, they were any inmate would do. Someone had done something, and didn't matter what he said. He said he was stomped. He said he lost control of his bladder, his bowels. And he just said to me, you know, all he could yell was, "God sees you. God knows what you're doing."
Yeah.
You know, and I was, in all of these cases where this was, you know, evidence right before me, I would say, you know, we have to do something. I would be so upset. You know, we have to get justice. And every single one of them would just say, "No, no, no. Don't you understand? Next time they will kill me." They would say, and I felt so, it was such a quandary for me, because, you know, this righteousness, we have to get justice, we have to do something, and yet on the other hand, I had to respect confidentiality, I had to acknowledge that by saying something, I couldn't guarantee they wouldn't be placed in greater danger. So there was, like, your hands were tied. They were just terrified for anything to be said. It's a very dangerous business, pointing your finger at your captors.
Yeah.
So when people I see in courts bringing cases against someone for a beating, I just know that it takes tremendous courage on their part. And they're the exceptions, the ones who actually make it into court to bring charges against these guys. Who you know, who do these, I mean, they're thugs.
Yep, you gotta call it like it is.
Well, it is. I mean, you have decent people in there.
Yes.
But you have these people who are clearly on the wrong side of the bars. And what really upset me was, well, what about the good ones? They know this is happening. They know this is going on. You know, why do they allow this? You know, I got a partial answer from a captain after my book was written who I met, a retired correction captain. And I just point blank, you know, "You seem like a decent guy. What did you do?" And he said that they have the same issues as the inmates of being labeled a snitch.
Mm.
That if they, kind of a, like a Serpico thing,
yep.
you,
yep.
quote, rat someone out and there's an issue and no one comes to back you up, it's terrible.
Yeah. Mary, we have a caller, and his name is Nick, and he's calling from Trinidad. Go on, Nick. And thank you.
Hi. I'm thinking of when I heard a story on Democracy Now! About a younger kid. I'm not sure if he was under 18 or if they can even go to Rikers Island. But he got put in there for stealing a backpack or something.
Khalif Browder.
Yeah.
And was kind of forgotten in the system and then eventually got out and committed suicide, I think.
Yes, he did.
I was just wondering how something like that happens. And also when you were commenting on the people that got, you know, like beat up inside, is there not surveillance? I don't understand how... You know, people get forgotten and people get beat up and nobody sees who's doing these things. And
yeah,
I don't know. That's my question.
Yeah. Mary?
Well, okay. Yeah, I think there's two questions here. The first one is Khalif Browder. Such a tragic case. But I will say this. He is not isolated.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book. I met many Khalif Browders. You know, I give the case of a kid that I worked with who was in a motorcycle accident, and he was, again, could not afford bail. This is where this bail issue is so huge. Khalif Browder could not pay the money to stay on the outside and fight the case of the stolen backpack. And the idea of a speedy trial is, it's just a joke. he for 3 years waited for his quote speedy trial, and in that time he was beaten up, he was placed in solitary confinement, horribly traumatized, and he just never recovered from it. When they finally gave up and just dropped the charges, said, okay, go home, you're not going to admit to anything. Most people are going to give in to the plea bargain offer just to get out of Rikers Island, just to, you know, because they have obligations on the outside. It's a big limbo-like state that you're living in. You don't have certainty, and it's a hard state for people to be in. And if you're offered the expediency of the plea bargain, just say you did it and you can go home. You want to wait for trial? Okay. It's very open-ended. Could be years and years. Well, most people are going to just say, where do I sign? Khalif Browder was very remarkable because he refused to do that, and ultimately it cost him his life. But he's not isolated.
Would it be accurate to say that if you choose not to go that path, that you are really going to be completely undefended inside and potentially forgotten about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if he was forgotten about. It's just the system is so terrible. The clock just kept stopping and delays and adjournments, and it went on for a period of 3 years. He was continually offered a plea bargain. Just say you did it, and you can go home, and he wouldn't do it.
Right.
So now he's looking for trial, and they don't want to go to trial with this. It's not worth it, and ultimately the system just gave up. So I don't think he was forgotten, but in terms of being defending yourself in there, it's very difficult. That's why many people join gangs, because you're going to find safety in a gang.
Yeah.
And everyone is quick to say, you know, all these gangs on Rikers. Well, the culture is ripe for, creates that. The levels of desperation that are imposed on people drive gang membership.
Yeah, and thank you, Nick, for your call very much.
Yeah, thank you for your information. I was struck by the Browder story, and it just seems so far away that you never get any real insight on it. So I appreciate that.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah.
Not just Khalif Browder, but Sandra Bland come to mind right around the same amount of time, in the same time frame, more or less, that this was happening. So we talked about guard abuse. That is that what is referred to as the goon squad?
Well, the goon squad was called the Emergency Response Services Unit, and they were there to quell any uprising, to provide physical intimidation. If there's any issue in a house, they'd be summoned, and they went around the island to all the jails, and they were gargantuan proportions. And they wore these kind of padded outfits. Their nickname was the Ninja Turtles, but on a more somber note, they were just called the Goon Squad because of the way they would just come in and, you know, beat people up. And they were very feared on the island.
And gladiator fight. I'm sorry.
But they had a formal name, Emergency Responses Services Unit.
Yeah. What about gladiator fights? Alex's story.
Yes, well, that actually took place in California.
Oh, yes.
He, again, a gang member. He was a high-ranking member of the Latin Kings, but once again, you know, formed a very human relationship with him. And then he shared with me his experiences. He was very cynical about the system. You know, he said, it's all just a joke. You go to these prisons supposedly to learn your lesson, and he was very sarcastic about it. And then he revealed that when he was in a prison in California, he said the California prisons were the worst. He said the gangs out there, many of the COs are gang members, and he showed me how they have gang tattoos on their wrists, and they have wristwatches that cover them, but he showed me how they push back the face of it, and you can see the tattoo, and how he said they got their sport from having us fight each other, you know, to the death.
Wow.
And he said it was just, everyone was terrified of this, and he was put in a position with another guy, and he just said, I was, I can remember him just shaking and quivering and saying, "I was so scared. I was so scared." And they just said, "They made you go. You're in the yard." And he said, "I had nothing against this other guy, nothing at all." And, and then he just looked at me and he said, you know, when he saw my shank, he knew it was over.
Oh, man. Wow.
And then I killed him.
Ooh. You know, in your book, you said something that jumped right at me, and we're in the last 9 or 10 minutes of our conversation. I can't believe how quickly it's gone. I will still invite callers at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-5911. You came to a place after these years on Rikers and the various places where you worked, and it was when you I think your turning point was when you got to the SHU and really saw firsthand, up close and personal, and I don't know how you did it, but you referred to, you felt like nothing more than monitors of human suffering.
Yeah.
So I say, if you were that, what are the guards, and how do they square their roles, and administrators for that matter, guards and administrators, how do they square their roles in this? They see it too.
Yes, and they are affected by it.
Yes, they are.
Working in the Bing was the most dreaded post on Rikers Island, and I believe that they got a stipend for doing it. No one wanted to work there. Hmm. I mean, you're being asked to just stand guard, to witness human misery. That's your job on a daily basis. And, you know, I think I mentioned in the book, too, that the parking lots at Rikers were just, I mean, huge parking lots. When I was there, there was over 20,000 inmates on Rikers. So, you know, a typical upstate prison has 2,000, so it was huge. It's about half that now. But the parking lots were covered in broken liquor bottles. And this is all the COs, mm-hmm. when their shifts ended. The drinking was it was just unbelievable. I had to, you know, use a dustpan and broom to pull into a spot. Yeah. It was just part of life there was this, just this, I interpret it as this anesthetizing themselves for this work. It's very, it doesn't work for anyone.
No.
For no one. Just the way we handle criminal justice or the penal system, it doesn't work. And so the people who worked in there, they hated it. They were pretty depressed, miserable.
They suffer shorter lifespans.
Yes,
prison guards
do.
Of all the, police or military, their lives end sooner. And I think about that, you know, I mean, I'm not a scholar on this subject, but just trying to imagine a guard. I can't call them correction officers because they don't correct, so I won't use the terminology. But mm-hmm. but guards are there in prison all day, too,
yeah.
and they walk by these cages, these solitary cages, at least like up here in Pelican Bay, with no windows, nothing that you could see through a slot where the lousy food goes through. And there are these men, these human beings in these boxes. They
yeah.
see this day in and day out, and then when their shift is over, they go home and, "Hi, honey, I'm home," and the kids come running and jumping. No, I don't buy that for a second.
Yeah.
They pay a price, and maybe they need to form an organization.
Yeah.
Correctional Officers Against Solitary Confinement. I'll put them on. I'll put them on the radio.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. Well, you are a blessed woman because, you know, I don't know. Are your parents still alive? I think not. I think you.
No, they passed.
But your father, you write about in your book, and he gave you some very sage input as you would talk to him about the trials and tribulations of the place where you work. What did he tell you?
Well, my father was a lawyer, and he was very not enthused about my work there at all. Whereas my mother was in the beginning much more interested, but he was aware of the grimness of it. I don't think my mother was, and as it became more grim, I think it got harder for her to hear about. And then I was able to talk to him a lot more about people with the bail and, you know, mm-hmm. and he would just blunt and say, look, it unless you've got bucks, unless you've got money, he said, this is the way it is. He was very blunt, you know, it's not what people believe. He understood what the system was. He really wanted me out of there, just out of there. And then in the Bing, I think, I'm not sure what you're referring to exactly, but every single day we had people who were attempting suicide, whether they were, you know, acting out, so to speak, or whether they truly wanted to die. You couldn't tell the difference anymore, and you could get the same result, death, regardless of what the intention was. And he had a fear that if somebody did die, that I was the acting chief at that time, that it would be, I would be blamed, even though we had a team of psychiatrists and such. And, you know, what he said to me is, you're getting so used to this. He said, do you realize how little it takes for someone to die? And he was right about that. You become inured to it. Mm. I'd have to say that what shocked me in the Bing and solitary in the beginning did not have the same effect on me, you know, a few weeks and months into it. It still disturbed me, but I started smoking. What was, you know, with the guards with their drinking, something happens to you. And he wanted to protect me, and he wanted me to, he wanted a memo sent that if anything happens, there's very inadequate administrative oversight here, which was the case, which is a whole other story of how that came to be. But he really insisted that I cover my own self.
Yeah.
And he said, you've done everything you can for these people. It's time for you to take care of you.
Yeah.
Your own survival here is at stake.
You bet.
And in the end, it became my decision to leave. It became came down to, I think, self-preservation.
Yeah. Well, we are just getting really close to running out of time here. I want to recommend to my listeners out there, our listeners, to get this book, Lockdown on Rikers. It'll really give you some frontline insight into the day-to-day. And Rikers Island is just a microcosm of all of our prisons and institutions in this country that really, really desperately need to change and reform. So in the minute and a half we have left, Mary, I want to know what you're doing now. And have you caught up with any of the inmates? You got about a minute.
Okay.
Two minutes.
Okay. Well, since the book came out, I've kind of switched from trying to help people on the inside. I'm doing it now from the outside. I give a lot of talks. I've written a ton of articles. If anyone wants to go to marybuser.com, I've written about solitary confinement in the Washington Post. I've done, you know, TV excerpts with, public TV here about Rikers Island. So I'm involved in a lot with solitary confinement, social workers against trying to raise awareness around why mental health professionals and the helping professions are participating in this. I'm also interested in parole reform. Every mm-hmm. aspect of mm-hmm. this it's very complex. There are many angles to our criminal justice system, and it has to be kind of attacked from so many sides.
Yes.
Because it is not at all what the public thinks that it is.
Yep.
And I give a lot of talks, and it's great when I talk to people who just shake their heads and say, I didn't know. Other countries are doing a very good job.
Yes.
And getting a much better result in terms of recidivism. We are not the model. What we have here is very violent, very depressing, and very most unfair, just
yes.
very unjust.
Wow. So, Mary, yeah. it's been a pleasure. And by the way, the spelling of your last name is B-U-S-E-R, for those of you who want to get the book, B-U-S-E-R, and they can look you up online. Thank you so much, A, for writing the book, B, for being on Thursday Night Talk on the line with me, Sharon Fennell. We'll talk again because there's so much we didn't get to and there's so much more to talk about. I know you'll be back on. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Sharon.
You're welcome.
All righty. Good night.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. Thank you to our host, Sharon Fennell, and to our guest, Mary Buser. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email ThursdayNightTalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on Thursday Night Talk, impeachment, tax reform, DNC controversies, third-party campaign, and other political topics to be discussed with Chuck Rogers and other guests, along with host Eric Kirk. That's November 9th, next week, beginning at 7. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next.
Tune in to the KHSU Magazine, KHSU's midday public affairs program. Join hosts Claire Reynolds, Brian Curtis, Katie Whiteside, Lorna Bryant, and Danielle.